It's amazing how I can control a crowd of 200 people by doing picking up this microphone, but not five. It seems like I will have to, you know, steadily.
I don't know what the panel's about, but I think we all want to just keep talking about bar fights.
Apparently, we're not having a plenary session on anything that I thought was going to happen, so that's perfectly fine.
Cthulhu in a bar fight?
Yeah. Well, are you kidding me? You've got to be joking. Good morning, everybody. Thank you very much for coming to the Saturday morning plenary. We appreciate everybody being up this early. We appreciate certainly the panelists being up this early. We have a very interesting talk. As you people that attended yesterday know, that plenary was quite rarefied in its focus. And this plenary today on operative magic will be quite practically focused, or at least that's what I have in mind. Apparently what actually happens will be whatever it is that happens. We, again, have a fantastic group of panelists today, authors, teachers, visionaries, people who have made enormous contributions to a wide variety of magical communities and magical paths. People with very interesting, and I am certain, different perspectives on the topic we have today on operative magic, its risks, its rewards, and its limitations. We have Dolores Ashcroft Nowicki, who is with us from the original Jersey, the Isle of Jersey. And the director of the Servants of the Light. We have John Michael Greer, who is with us locally now, there in Maryland, and the Grand Archdruid. 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 Archdruid.
Like Archbishop.
Right.
I'm one of those two.
Of the ancient order of druids in America. We have Jason Miller,
Universal Gnostic.
Sorcerer, and member of the Chthonic Orarnian Temple and the Sangreal Solidarity. Christopher Pinzak, author and founder of the Temple of Witchcraft tradition. And Jackie Smith, who is the founder and owner of Coventry Creations. All of them are well-respected and well-published authors and teachers and leaders within their communities. What the panel is going to be, or where we're going to start, and as people know, I allow the panelists usually to go wherever they need to go, because oftentimes they're far more creative in their questioning of each other than I am in my questioning of them. But we are discussing operative magic, sometimes referred to as low magic. That magic, spell work, that is used to make a direct manifest change on the world and in one's personal life. It is not the kind of magic used to connect to the divine, but it is the kind of magic used to find a new job. Now, we live in a particularly commercialized world, and I was thinking one of the things that comes to mind is the hype and the marketing of things like The Secret, where...
is it Collective Shutter?
Where magic is sold as a panacea, as a silver bullet, in which if you simply do these one or two things, you can create and make whatever change in the world you desire. But the more important part for us, who as people who practice magic, and I will be opinionated about this. As people who practice real magic, we recognize that every action that we take has consequences. That coming into the manifest world means accepting certain limitations. And so the question that we want to explore today is, what do experienced magicians and witches and sorcerers see as the role of operative magic in changing personal circumstances and the world at large? What are the risks? What are the limitations? And what are the rewards? So enough about me. What I would like, if the panelists wouldn't mind, and we can begin at either end, if you would make a kind of an opening statement concerning your ideas or what your basic concept of operative magic and what you think its role is within our lives and the lives of magical people. And you have, 3 minutes each.
Go.
Okay. Well, I'm going to pull rank. At 83, I'm the oldest here, so listen up, Grandma speaking. One of the things that I think has to be looked at when you begin magical work is the very careful building of a magical personality first. You have to go through a self-assessment and ask yourself, have I the patience? Have I the dedication? Have I the right mental attitude to practice magic, to learn about magic? Because it does require patience, and it does require dedication. And dedication is, it's not a word that a lot of people know about or use these days. We have people who come into our school and we say, we want from you 14 to 16 hours of study a week, less than you would be required in a university. Oh, I can't manage that. I've got to get the children from school. Fine, get Granny to get them from school. That you can work around things. The other thing that I would pick up from something that Michael has said is spellcraft. Now, I work with words. I love words. Words, to me, are living things, and they need to be used in the most beautiful and apt way possible. And when I sort of read some of the books, the sort of paranormal novels that are going around, and even some really good authors that I like attempt to write a spell, and I think, there's no rhyme or reason with it. So, yes, a gift for words, a love of words. And it all comes down to rhythm. Rhythm in your life, a rhythm in the way you speak, a rhythm in the way you live. I love magic. I see it as the most wonderful thing that I ever came into contact with, and I was lucky. I was born into an occult family. I've lived with it all my life. It is my life, and will continue to be until that last moment when I say, enough, I'm off.
In terms of practical magic, operative magic, if you want to use that term, I find that it has one huge advantage and plays a very important role in any form of magical training, however austere and theurgical it may be, which is that it's a bullshit filter. How many of you, this has become a lot less common recently, but how many of you have encountered the kind of person who claims 15 exalted titles in various untraceable lineages and lives in his mom's basement next to the washing machine? Or, you know, is sick all the time and can't keep a job and sponges off her friends, but she's still, you know, the high priestess, beloved of the goddess. Or what have you. Now, obviously there are people who actually have who have serious health problems, and it's not their fault. There are people who have serious financial problems, and it's not their fault. But if you have somebody whose life has gone to hell and stays there, and is apparently making itself quite comfortable down there among the, you know, among the various horned and hooved individuals, and that's their métier, that's their idiom, and yet they're going on about how powerful they are. Something is being missed here. I have argued in the past that one of the things the pagan community badly needs is martial arts training. Not for all the many other benefits, but because it's immediately clear who's been doing their practices. And that's, you know, even in a fairly quote, light, unquote, I know I'm going to get elbowed for this sooner or later, probably very painfully, like Tai Chi, which I practiced extensively. It takes about 2 minutes of push hands before you find out that the person who's been going on endlessly with their mouth about how powerful they are is bouncing off the wall. And the person who's just been quietly doing the thing is standing there going, well, that was pretty easy, wasn't it? So I certainly encourage the practice of operative magic among my personal students and generally, because it gives you a chance, first of all, to see how good you actually are, as opposed to building up these vast fantasies about being, you know, the ultimate inheritor of what's it. The whole bad fantasy fiction. Somebody mentioned The Secret, speaking. I want to tell a brief story about that, okay? I want to tell a brief story about that, because I was living in Ashland, Oregon, when The Secret burst upon the New Age scene. And Ashland is a very yuppified town. And it has a lot of New Agey people. There are lots of people there who are right now quivering on the edge of their seats waiting for the Space Brothers to arrive on December 21st. There are a lot of other people who are quivering on the edge of their seats expecting the evil space lizards, David Icke's pet reptiles, to show up on December 21st, or what have you. But when The Secret came out, people were agog. They were all into it. Everybody was talking about it. And then about 6 months later, you started seeing all these workshops being offered, how to make The Secret work for you. And then about 6 months after that, it was, what are the obstacles that are preventing The Secret from working for you? And then about 6 months after that, everyone ditched it and went into flipping real estate. And you know how that worked out. I hate to break it to such people, but you know, the universe does not exist for the purpose of giving you a Rolls Royce.
Oh, okay. Shit.
I know. I'm just one. Just that ray of sunshine in everyone's life, you know. But the thing is, again, there's a difference between the fantasy that that all the powers of the universe are you know, exist to provide you with whatever goodies you happen to want, and the actual realities of operative practical magic, which can accomplish some remarkable things, but which have limits. That's a swear word in some circles, by the way. But we'll be talking more about that.
Can I just add something to that?
Certainly.
Yeah. Don't bother about buying The Secret. Go out and buy 50 Shades of Grey. At least you'll get something out of it. She worked magic. She became a billionaire.
It's a slightly more honest way of having your hands down your panties.
All yours.
How do I follow that up? I
definitely lower the tone.
I view practical magic, I view spell work as being connected with liturgic work, the work of the divine, or the work of clarification and enlightenment. And, you know, I view it connected in that it's an outward expression of whatever realization you have. So, you know, the mystic, the pure mystic, is just seeking that divine embrace. And the magician is seeking that divine embrace and seeking to reflect it outward, let that light of gnosis shine outward into the world. And hopefully that's through actions, both magical and mundane. And, you know, the pillar of my career in strategic sorcery is that mixing of the mundane and the overtly magical, because one just doesn't seem to mesh without the other. So, you know, I view it all as being connected with one another. Operative magic without a practice, a spiritual practice, without meditation, is just a really good way to muck up your life a bit. And then without the practical things, the biggest problem with the secret is that it actively recommended against doing the normal things you would do. I mean, the secret unbelievably stated, you know, well, if you go to McDonald's and eat a double quarter pounder every day, but don't believe you'll get fat, you won't get fat. And it's just sort of, wow, you know? Exactly. Turned out they were wrong. you know, so it's all actions from the highest to the lowest have to be linked together in a chain to make change work and settle and be the change you want it to be. You know, in a way, I view magic as a type of life hacking. You know, they this new word for really just doing things the way they're supposed to be done, or being slightly clever about how you do things. But that's nothing new. I think you, in your introduction to the Picatrix, had said, you know, the people that are operating this should be fluent in rhetoric and
we'll get to
geometry and so on and so forth. So it's really, you know, someone who's looking to enchant for their job. Well, you can enchant for your job all that you want, but if you are handing Evo a resume to work in the store and it has, you know, graveyard dust on the corners and, you know, smudges of job-finding oil everywhere, it looks like you just ate fried chicken and then gave him the resume, or, you know, you mailed him the resume and it's got, you know, white hire me powder. He thinks, you know, he's calling Homeland Security. So, you know, if you Google, like, court closures, the amount of courthouses that have been temporarily closed because of powder in envelopes, you would think, you know, there's like a massive terrorism outbreak, but then they test it and they find out that it's all like talcum powder braced. And the amount of instances of this happening have dramatically increased since Cat Ironwood started her hoodoo course. And people have just been like, oh, I got a court case, gotta mail in some court case powder, make sure there's enough. Like, no, you know, not going to help you.
If I may interject something.
The Miami City Police Department has a special squad to remove dead livestock from the front of the courthouse.
Yeah. Really? Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Those, you know, mundane sorceress action and divine action all has to work in harmony for it to work. And if any one of those is just sort of out of whack, you know, then you'll wind up either a pure mystic, which is fine, There's nothing wrong with that. Or if you're divorced from that and you're only working the mundane, you'll wind up as, you know, maybe the CEO of Ernst & Young, which is fine, I guess. if that's what you want to do with your life. you know, you'll wind up as some practical magic person who lives in their mom's basement because all they do for anything is spell work
and
without... There you go. So that's it for me.
All right. Well, when you come to a convention or event like Between the Worlds and you open up the program book and realize, hey, I'm on a panel. I didn't know that. And you start thinking about, oh, operative magic. And, you know, my initial thoughts of this, I thought I'd be able to start my, you know, opening statement with, wow, I disagree totally with the total premise of the panel. But as we've kind of progressed down the line, I think we're kind of heading in a similar direction. When I was a baby witch, you know, when I started out, I was actually trained down in Salem, Massachusetts, which for those who have spent any time there, it's a very unique place. And that's all I'll say. but as part of my unique training, we didn't really get a division between high and low magic. We didn't really get a division between that. And that was something that really, in my own education and reading and coming across other magicians and speaking to them, that division became more clear to me. And one of the things that I think was a benefit of that was this idea that desire is sacred. And the idea of my practical, operative, kind of folk magic, witchy practice actually informed my deeper spiritual connection to the gods, to my own soul, to my own work, to what I might call my true will now, although that's not what they called it then. And so really kind of looking at this pattern of, well, if I want something, that's not inherently good or bad, but it is. So I should probably explore that if that's so deeply on my mind. And so if I'm wanting something, you know, I had a yoga teacher who talked a lot about desire, and you know, in a funny way, she would say, you know, you want something, you get it. Isn't that great? Oh, you wanted something, you didn't get it. Isn't that great? I was like, no, it's not great. But it took me a while to figure that out, you know. And when you got something, then it satisfied that desire, and you could kind of evaluate and do the introspection of, was that what I thought it was going to be? And more times than not, I would get what I did the spell for, but I was like, oh, this really wasn't that important, or maybe it was, and it made me really happy, but I could kind of evaluate in the spectrum and importance of my life, where did that fall? And then if I didn't get something, it was an opportunity to evaluate, you know, did I not get it because my spellcraft was faulty? And that's always an option. I think a lot of people forget that. You know, was I just fighting against the tides? Was I not having a good day? Did I totally not know what I was doing for this type of magic? But if the spellcraft wasn't faulty and you kept on repeating a spell over the course of a year and it wasn't happening, was there something in me that was blocking it? And if there was something that was blocking it within me, was it something that I needed to heal and then I could get it? Or was it something I needed to let go of and figure out, well, why do I want this so badly? Do I really actually want something that's kind of destructive to me? You know, because sometimes, I know this is going to be shocking, but sometimes we want things that are bad for us. You know, where Jackie and I were talking yesterday and said, if you really want to get rid of somebody, pray for, you know, them to, from the Jewish tradition, pray for them to get everything that they want. You know, sometimes it's not everything it's cracked up to be. So do I want something that would be destructive for me? And can, maybe I'm on some level, and the intention I always learned to put into all my operative magic was, I ask this be for my highest good, I ask this be in accord with my soul's purpose, something like that. And I don't think that always protects you, I don't think that always makes things turn out wonderfully and all rosy, but it does have kind of an underlying base intention of trying to combine this operative magic with this higher magic. It's an opportunity for me to align myself with this kind of soul's purpose. And that really affected the way I looked at operative magic. And as I started to get out in the wider world beyond Salem, Massachusetts, I realized not everybody looked at it that way. And even lots of the folks in Salem really didn't look at it that way, but I was naive to think that they did. But so for me, I don't really see them as divorced. I think desire is sacred, and I think of every action of operative magic that was either successful or has failed was a great opportunity for me to figure out a deeper connection to my spirituality. You know, by whether it be, I think one of my most spiritual spells was finding my husband. You know, and it utterly changed my life, and it was that operative magic of at the time I felt I wanted to be with somebody, and I was lonely, and why didn't I have a partner, and kind of doing the self-work to be okay with that, and then cast the spell. So it was a real deep part of my spiritual evolution, yet it was something that was considered to be operative magic, love magic, but it worked. So I don't see them as so separate, I guess is the bottom line.
We're in more agreement than I thought we were.
I'll fix that.
Okay. The way I approach magic is really based on the fact that I have 7 aspects in Virgo in my horoscope chart. There's days it's really difficult to be me because I analyze everything. I analyze myself more than I analyze the rest of the world. And it's all about what do I need to do to fix this. And my biggest theory and my biggest practical application of magic is that magic absolutely 100% demands that you change. It demands that you change because if you need to do a spell about something, then something within you is short-circuited or not working right. Because if you got it, you don't need to do a spell about it. And this came because I really watched people that had different issues with different things. I have a friend who can't keep a man. Oh, Lord, she cannot keep a man. And every day, well, every month, it's like the next love spell. And then I have, you know, myself who I can't keep a book. So what's my issue as I do prosperity spell after prosperity spell? And then I say, why? Why am I doing all this magic over and over and over again? Because really all it is a Band-Aid. Your quick spell, all it is a Band-Aid. That's why magic demands change. Because you can do the same thing over and over again and get the same results over and over again, and we all know that's just the definition of insanity. And most of us are absolutely crazy. But what you have is an opportunity to heal. So to me, magic is about changing you. And then the rest of the world changes around you, not because it changed, but because your perspective on it changes. And that's really what operative magic is. So to me, it's not separate either. Operative magic is about healing the self. And as I explain this, and I... God bless you, God bless you. One more time. Okay. So to me, operative magic is absolutely the same as divine work, because what you're doing is you're peeling away the layers. Well, it's an opportunity to peel away the layers. And it's fun. It is so fun to have someone come into the store, someone give me a call and say, okay, all right, I did my come to me spell. And I got him to call me, but then his mother interfered. I swear to God, she's putting some magic on me too. She's doing some, I swear she's a conjurer too. I said, well, so it becomes the conversation of, why do you want him? Why him? Well, because blah, 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 blah. He's exactly what I want. And so then being able to turn that person's perspective internally to say, well, what's stopping you? What's stopping you? Why is the world reacting to you in this way? And really, at our dinner last night, we talked about when you're in the public eye, you get a lot of interesting attacks from the rest of the world about their perception of you. And so what I did personally in that process, and I've helped other people do, is why is it okay? What's going on in me? What's the agreement that I have with the universe that makes it okay to be under attack? What is it feeding within me? So when you need magic, when you're looking at a magical resolution to something, it's usually because you have a different kind of agreement with the universe to say, this is feeding something within me. This is feeding my martyr complex. And I got to tell you, that's an awesome and powerful situation there. So it feeds something within you. So as I go further than my 3 minutes, I think it's pretty much one and the same. It just demands that you change.
I'd like to say I quite agree with you in many ways, Joe. But first and foremost, I'd like to say, why are we talking about magic? I want. What about operational and ordinary low magic to give? Isn't there another way of using it? Why is it that we always say, oh, I'm going to do a spell to get this, or I'm going to do a spell to get that? How about I'm going to do a spell to make something happen for somebody else? You know, magic is a two-way thing. You can use it, yes, I wouldn't say to get things. I would say you use magic to create a circumstance in which, with some effort, you can acquire what is necessary for you. You don't have to make a spell and then sit back. Magic doesn't work that way. You have to put the effort into it first.
You have to meet it halfway.
I quite agree with that.
One of the things that I tend to teach students and that I mention in my books is that if you're doing any kind of a magical working that has a practical aspect, immediately after finishing it, go do something practical to make that happen. Yeah. And this, one of the things that I talk about in my book, The Druid Magic Handbook, for example, is ecological magic, magic to help heal the earth. That's obviously, you know, druids get into that kind of thing, and we're weird that way. And, but one of the things that I advise people, when you're doing this kind of working, after you are finished, you know, go out and pick up some litter. Go do something. Kabbalistically speaking, I'm going to shift gears here slightly, if it does not come down to Malkuth, if it does not come down to the sphere of material manifestation, it doesn't complete the arc of descent and ascent. And if that happens, it'll simply short-circuit on the realm of the imagination, meaning you're going to sit there saying, oh, I'm doing such wonderful things for the earth, and then climb in your SUV to drive 3 blocks to the grocery store. There is way too much of that. And so, basically, another way of saying the same thing is simply that your will has to be single to make magic work, and that means that all of your life needs to express what it is that you're trying to make happen. Most of the situations I know in which people are saying, oh, I've been doing a spell to get X, Y, and Z. Okay, that's fine. Look at their lives. Look at what they're actually doing. And they're actually willing at least two incompatible things at the same time. Mm. I want to get $1 million, but I also want to spend every dollar I get. Okay? I want to get in a relationship, but I want the relationship to cater to me all the time, and so on and so forth. I'm sure you can think of hundreds of examples, and if you can't think of any in your own life, look harder, because we. But yeah, you know, it has to come down to practical change in your own life. It's what the statue of Apollo said to Renia Maria Rilke: "Du musst dein Leben ändern." You must change your life.
You know, last year I did a workshop up in Scotland, and just for the hell of it, because I was feeling like making a statement, I said to them, I'm going to teach you how to manifest a 10-pound note. And I went into all the things that you can do to manifest a 10-pound note. You can work for it. Somebody will pay back something that they owe you. You can sell something. You can go out and look around the pavements outside a pub at 11 o'clock at night because maybe somebody's going to drop one. Or, you know, you can go out and sort of hang a red light outside the door. In my case, it would be pale pink. Now, everybody got a bit antsy about this, and she said, oh, but can't you just do a spell? And I said, no, you've got to put something in before you get your thing out. Mm-hmm. And we went through this little session, and then afterwards a woman came up to me, and she said, I'd like to buy one of your books. And I said, fine, you know, here you are, £10. And she said, I've only got 20. And I said, that's all right, I've got a £10 note. And when she gave me the 20 and I gave her the 10, I said, that is your £10. And she said, it took a little while for this to sink in, you know. But after a while, you know, when the workshop ended, I began to get back little sort of bits and pieces. One woman said to me, she said, I drove home, she said, and I parked my car, and she said, I got out of the car, and there was a £10 note on the gravel. And she said, I picked it up and went in and said to my husband, you know, we've been doing this spell to get a £10 note, and look what I found. And he said, that's where I dropped it. He said, yeah, I knew I had three of the £10 notes. He said, and I looked in my wallet when I went to get something else out. he said, I must have dropped. She said, no, it's mine. I found it. Magic can work.
After I wrote Financial Sorcery, and if you've read it, you know that at least 60 to 70% of the book is not about spell work or the glyphs or anything like that. It's, you know, how to open up an IRA, how to, you know, the tools you need to make a side business work, how to transition from, you know, a day job to your side job, and lots of, you know, it's 70% financial advice and the other 30% how to weave magic into that. And so most people were receptive to it, but I did upset a number of people in saying that, you know, lottery magic to win millions and millions of dollars and never think about money again is not the way to go. So I did get a couple people to write me and said, you know, well, what you wrote is absolutely against what the grimoires tell us. The grimoires tell us that if we, and you know, there's lots of guys nowadays that are grimoire traditionalists. And it's fine.
The word you want is grimoire fundamentalist.
Yeah, grimoire well, I was going to say, he is a grimoire traditionalist in that, you know, this is the grimoire. Hey, let's try it out how it says. But then there's fundamentalists where it's like, well, the grimoire says that gold will just manifest in the circle. And the, you know, and if it doesn't, I'm not doing it right. And, you know, they were like, well, I would say, okay, so how many grimoire magicians now or throughout history are, you know, meeting in their, you know, are these conferences happening in Monaco? You know, we don't have the case where John Michael Greer, Aaron Leach, and Jason Miller all race our Aston Martins.
I don't drive. That would be kind of challenging.
You would have a driver.
Okay.
None of us would drive. We would, you know, sit and drink our coffee while our drivers raced. But, the, you know...
This is why I went out and bought 50 Shades of Grey.
And, you know, so they were upset. They were like, you know, but, well, then how do you... It's not good science then, because if you're doing all this stuff to make money, if you're saying that I want to manifest money, I do the spell and then open a side business so income can come in, how do I know the magic's working and it's not just a successful side business? And I'm like, do you really fucking care? I mean, I'm all for charting your results and things like that, but really? Like, does it matter? Exactly. You know? Oh, you know, Publisher's Clearinghouse knocks on the door. Is like, well, here's your money. No, I'm waiting for a demon to bring it. Sorry.
Well, we did decide on Thursday that we were going to start writing porn because it pays more, so it can support our spiritual.
I'll go along with that.
Okay. You're on.
Well, I just started a new publishing company, everyone. We're accepting submissions of porn.
You know.
For the record, my background is in Tibetan Buddhism, and there are at least three translators of Tibetan Buddhism who secretly make money on the side writing porn. I just thought I'd point that out.
Many years ago, I used to go up to North Wales to see she was a student. She was also a very great friend. She also was a writer for Milton Boone. And on that money that she brought in, a single mother with three children, she paid their way through university. She paid for their first cars, and she gave each of them a deposit to get their first house. You know, I used to look down my nose at Milton Boone, and she had a load of friends that they used to all congregate together and swap ideas. And I was being a bitch and sort of said, you know, well, I write books. Yeah. And Mary Wibberley, who was a big Milton Boone writer, she said, don't you dare look down your nose at me. She said, I pay bills. I bring up my family. And she said, what I do is give women who have no dreams a dream to follow. They can read a book of mine, and for a moment, for an hour, they can be young again, they can be beautiful, they can be married to a rich man. And she said, and then they get up and do the washing. Porn pays, Jill.
Yeah, porn pays.
Sorry, my apologies. I thought it was Jill. I gave you the wrong name.
I answered it just about anything but bitch. Oh, wait, I answered that too. I get called that all the time. One of the things that I talk about a lot is wild magic, and it's just a name that I give it. And that's the magic of your actions. That's the magic of kindness. That's the random magic that you create just by what you do out in the world. And I watch it in action all the time, and there's a story that I usually tell in my class. So if you're going to be in my class, you're going to hear it twice. When I was on my way to a New Age trade show in Denver one year, and it was the first year that we were not hiding behind any reps or any distributors. We were out there. We were just going to do our own thing and see what happens. And we're in the, if you've ever been to Denver and you got to go rent a car, it's hell, because the car rental place is about 5 to 10 miles away from the airport, and you all get on the shuttle and you're crammed in like sardines, and you don't want to be that close to your neighbor. And there's this woman across the aisle from me in the back, and she looked amazing. 65-year-old woman, her hair was perfect. She had the perfect jewelry on. She was put together and not even matchy-matchy. But she looked sad. She was just looking down at her hands, and she looked a little stressed. And I just kept looking at her, and my husband points out that I have no sneak gene at all, and I stare at people, and I decide to own it and then tell people why I'm staring at them. And I leaned over and I said, I want to look like you when I get off a plane. I mean, my hair's standing up, my mascara's down my face, I'm all wrinkled. I said, you look amazing. And I said, I'm in awe, and I'm going to call you for fashion tips later. And she laughed, and she was happy, and we talked, and I said, what are you doing in Denver, and blah, 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 and that part of the story isn't important. And then we stopped talking, and we both went back to our 20-minute car ride to the car rental place. We get to the car rental place, and God help me, there was a line wrapped around the building. There were children running around screaming. People were mad. It was about 150 degrees out, and the air conditioning was broken, and all the computers were down. I'm not even kidding. Christopher knows.
Sounds like a typical ass.
So we get there to the car rental place, and I'm tired, and I'm crabby, and I get in line, and I'm desperately trying to beat the computer for self-serve, and it's not working, and I'm on my smartphone being dumb, and this woman starts talking to everybody. She's in a great mood now. I just told her she looks like $1 million, so she feels like $1 million, and I am not kidding you, and I have witnesses to this. She stopped the baby from crying. The dad could walk away from the mom who had the calm baby to wrangle the kids. Then his rest of his family was there, so then he handled all the kids, and then everybody got in line, and I swear to God, in 5 minutes, we were singing Kumbaya. But it really was from this one woman deciding that she was going to pass on this moment of kindness that I gave to her from my habit of staring. And then when we got to the show, and our immediate reward, upgrade. We always rent the teeniest, tiniest car for like $1.50 a day. And the one where you have to, it's the Flintstone car. And so we got an upgrade to a nice car. And I was a little, you could have the convertible or the HHR. And then the convertible wasn't available, so I ended up with the HHR. And then when we got to the show, we had the best show we've ever had. The best show we've ever had. And I sat down and I said, well, what do we do right? What do we do right, Patty? Was it, I lit a candle before I left, because I have a few. And I put the oil on the whole thing, on all of the displays and all that stuff. And we both decided it was that moment where we created magic by changing the world. And that's wild magic, and that is the most powerful magic you can do. So if there's something that you want, you give.
I think for me, one of the things I try to drill both in myself and students and people in our community is that everything is magical. Every thought we think is magic. Every word we speak is magic. Every action we take, they're all opportunities for magic. And things like this, you know, and just being kind to somebody on the shuttle out to the airport. And I think I was at that INET, so I have great appreciation for that day. It was really that sense of, you know, setting the tone, setting the intention. Some people say, and this is, you know, a controversial statement to some, that you shouldn't do any magic for something until you've exhausted all the possibilities in the mundane world. And I actually disagree with that totally. I do the magic first, and then I do the follow-up, and I feel like the magic and the meditation on something first to figure out, oh, is this really something I want and need? Then the ceremony or the candle or whatever it may be to do it, and it sets candle, yes. 12 of them. The big ones. But the idea that, you know, it sets this tone. It sets very clearly the universe. This is what I'm working towards. It gets all of my parts working towards that. So it's like I've checked in with the spiritual. I've asked, you know, really myself, is this what I really need? This is what I really want at this time. I'm now taking ritual action. I'm following it up with real world action. Everything's kind of working together. Now, I know it doesn't work that way for everybody, but that's how it seems to work best for me. And for the most of the time, for most of the operations that I do, things just seem to kind of fall into place in unexpected ways like that. But they turn out to be much better than I could have planned it out. You know, I try to give a lot of freedom to how the magic manifests because, you know, I think the divine intelligence often knows much better than I do.
What he said about the exhausting all mundane possibilities first. Man, I've heard that over and over and over and over again, and it's poison. And I'll give you an example. A friend of mine opened a retail shop in outside Philadelphia, and it was an ill-advised venture. And, you know, she had talked to a couple retail consultants, and two of them told her it was an ill-advised venture, and then the third one was like, well, I really need a consulting fee, so I'll tell her the best way to open the shop. And I'm sure he did his job in advising her well, but it just wasn't going to turn out well, period. But stuck with it, things are not going well. Stuck with it, moved some things around, sought out to inject more money, break into the retirement fund, inject more money. Finally, when things are just really, really bad within weeks of just having to go completely belly up, well, let's call Jason. So, you know, I come in and I visit the shop and, you know, we do a few things and in the back we set up a Trithemius's table and we talk to Tzadkiel and you know, usually these things manifest in coincidences happening afterwards. And but supposedly, the next morning, she woke up, and the next morning was a Thursday, and she said she walked into her living room, and Tzadkiel was in the television set. Television sets, by the way, when they're not on, can make great scrying mirrors.
First use I can think for one of them.
So she said she has this vision of Tzadkiel in the television set. And he just says, I'm sending someone, do what they say. So someone, sure enough, shows up to the shop. And, no, I'm sorry, I got the story wrong. Tzadkiel said, move the shop. So she decided to move the shop from Chestnut Hill to area off South Street. Then Tzadkiel appears to her and says, I'm sending someone, do what they say. Well, moving the shop put it in a location that was attractive for a buyer with a similar chain of shops to come in. So it didn't make her shop a success. It didn't even get them completely out of debt. it mitigated the largest part of it and stopped people from having to go into bankruptcy. So magic worked, but the point being is that emergency magic does what any other emergency does. It mitigates a disaster. It doesn't build wealth. So if you're trying to build something, do magic at the start and along the way, intermingled with each mundane step, not oh my God, it's falling to pieces. How do I stop it from falling to pieces? People have said, you know, they quote my emergency magic is bad magic statement, and they quote it like you shouldn't ever do emergency magic. And of course, emergencies happen to everyone, and sometimes, you know, the fit hits the shan and you need to do it.
Emergency love magic is way worse.
Yes, emergency love magic is. Yeah, well, talk about, you know, the dangers of magic. Man, worse than any demon that you could worry about is, you know, this relationship is falling apart. How do I keep it going? I hate my job. Oh, my God, I might get laid off. I better do magic to not get laid off. So, you know, we have as magicians the ability to maintain a status quo longer than a normal person does, and it's the biggest way to shoot ourselves in the foot.
I want to say something about the idea that magic is in some sense identical with everything in life, and while there's an important truth in that, it can also lead to certain kinds of idiocy that one sees now and again. I should mention the book of mine that's coming out in February, The Celtic Golden Dawn. There's going to be a website associated with it, and one of the things that website will have is not merely an FAQ page, but an FTT page, a frequently thrown tantrums page. I think it's long since time for those, simply because the same tantrums get thrown. And one of the things that as a teacher of some fairly ornate ceremonial traditions, I field now and again is the I sweat magic argument. I don't need to do all of this this fancy ceremonial stuff because magic pours off me like sweat. I'm quoting. I am literally...
Jackie's got a candle for that.
Yeah. I do.
That's a good thing. I was thinking possibly soap. but in fact, it occasionally becomes... You get claims out there from people who couldn't be bothered to actually do systematic magical training because they're convinced that they're just magically talented, you know. And it especially happens in puberty. And in fact, when the energy channels are coming open during puberty, very often people will get some, you know, remarkable effects. The energy just kind of zapping here and there, the equivalent of the near fatal testosterone poisoning that all young men experience. But it doesn't wear off, and so one gets this kind of thing. Magic is a lot of hard work. To become a capable magician takes as much work as becoming an expert martial artist or a really good musician. We all know what kind of band you get when everyone gets together 8 times a year to play the same tune with their friends. And we know the kind that you get when everybody's playing for an hour or two a day and really building their skills, and which one you want to listen to, and which one is going to conjure into being that mysterious power and agent. Or what have you, you know. So this is that Jason was mentioning the translation that I largely did, that Chris Warnock and I did, of the Picatrix a little while back, which was an interesting experience because it is literally a manual for professional wizards in the Dark Ages. And it talks about the kind of things you need to know to become a successful professional wizard, if that happens to be your career track. And it's not, you're not going to get it by, you know, reading half a dozen Scott Cunningham books, okay? The idea is that you should be in a position to render sensible advice to anyone under almost any circumstances, and then shape that advice by way of a complete mastery of astrology, which was the standard divination system at the time, and a thorough mastery of ritual magic, so you could add that additional push when needed. Oh, it also has a lot of stuff on making good poisons. Well, the wizards of the time very often were employed by political people on various levels, from you know the local baron right on up to the local king, and they had a lot of use for poisons in those days. It was an effective way to cause change in accordance with will.
See the courts of Louis the 14th and 16th.
For example,
no one told me that was an option.
Yeah. So basically, but to do this well is a full-time job. To do magic well is going to take you as much passion, as much effort, as much grueling daily practice as any other serious practice. I remember something in one of Dion Fortune's books where she talked about how all these people were not even willing to put the amount of work into magic that they would put into becoming good at their professions. And you're not going to get anywhere that way. And if you're convinced that magic pours off you like sweat, you know, okay, that's fine. Go take a shower. The rest of us have work to do.
People forget, I think, that this whole thing that we call magic, in a sense, is it becomes a profession. You have to work at it. And you have to be good at it. Otherwise, it will destroy you. There's a backlash when you misuse magic. There's also, I have discovered throughout my life, something called accidental magic. When something is given to you that you didn't know you needed, but it fulfills a need or points you in a direction. When I was little, when I was 8 years old, I said to my father, when I grow up, I'm going to travel all over the world. Now, this is in the early 30s, depression time. And he said to me, then you'll have to work hard at school and earn a lot of money, because it's going to take a lot of money to go around the world. My favorite game in the school holidays was to plot a world cruise going from place to place until I knew what the capital was, what currency was used, the places I wanted to see, the things that I could buy there. By the end of my 6 weeks or 5 weeks holiday, I was ready to go back to school, and I always came top in geography. It was one of the things. But since then, I have traveled around the world. But believe me when I tell you, there has never, ever been a large amount in my saving account. There isn't even now. Magicians, real magicians, don't really get rich, except in respect, in love, and the way in which people treat you, that's more than riches. There's a lady here who was instrumental in giving me something that I had always wanted. I always wanted to see Tierra del Fuego. It was a magical name to me. Every year I saved and saved and saved. And then the kids would say, Mom, I need. Or I need this, or I've got to pay that. And at 68 years old, that woman was instrumental in giving to me or making available to me enough money to make my dream come true. And I bless her for that. But it was accidental magic. I didn't actually do anything except really, really want that trip. And that, it seems, is sometimes enough.
Magic is a lot of hard work and a lot of study, but it's also a lot of experimentation. One day I woke up and I said, somebody had to figure this out at one point. Somebody had to pick that leaf off the bush and eat it and spit it back out. So why not you? If you know your ingredients, if you know your spell parts, if you know your spell parts like you know your porn collection, it's immediately effective. And you know exactly what you need to do to get the exact result you're looking for. But it's somebody has to figure this out. And you know yourself best, hopefully. Hopefully you're going to be courageous, not fearless, but courageous in exploring what you're made of and what stops you and what your fears are and how you're screwed up and what your parents did to mess up the rest of your life. And that courage to go in and look at that and then be your own advocate and experiment and go out and do this. And I might be very unpopular in this statement, but I find spells that are written in books to be guidelines, to be ideas. So many times I have somebody call me and go, okay, all right, I lit the candle, and it was on a Tuesday, and the moon was waning, and then I blew it out right away because I think I did it wrong. And really, it's, yeah, I'm not even kidding. Well, then there was that one call that said, I am so upset. I just read your ingredients, and I want to know if you use real dragon's blood. And as soon as they said it, they went, oh.
Tell them you have a dragon.
Tell them that you have a dragon that donates to the blood bank.
Well, so what happened was, I said, well, we do have a dragon blood donation clinic in the back for fairy dust addicted dragons. And that's why it's so potent.
Tell me, do dragons have blood types?
Yes, it's by element. Cha-ching. So... But really, you know, and so in one way, yeah, you can screw your magic up, and the ramifications are really all about you, because magic is all about you. And so the ramifications will be in your life because you've pressed a button within you that you weren't ready to press. And so that's when your magic doesn't work, the question is, how did I block it? How did I block it? And I'm going to give you one more thought. I probably have 20 more, but at this particular moment, magic takes two people. It always takes two people, you and the person who helps you manifest it, which might be the HR director that gets you the new job, or the guy who drops a 10-pound note, or, you know, or whatever. There's always a second person involved. And realizing that, I tell you what, I've done a little magic to bring the right person.
Dolores had talked about doing magic for others rather than for oneself, and I do a lot of magic for people, both because people pay me and because, you know, people just ask and I don't get paid. I think it's, you know. But one of the things that always happens is it rubs off. It's always, you know... When I'll one of the things that I'll do is I'll make a talisman or something, like you know, one of these you know, Tibetan yidam things that some of you are wearing, and I'll sit and accumulate 10,000 mantras over the course of quite some time, because I'm no longer living in Nepal, and with three kids I can't sit and accumulate 10,000 mantras in a sitting anymore. Those days are gone. So, you know, but while I'm doing it, you know, I remember doing the white Mahakala ones, who's, you know, for overcoming obstacles and things like that. Even though I did not keep one for myself, I felt so incredibly empowered, and things were going very, very smoothly as I was doing it and sending it out. So, you know, it was an incredible blessing on me to be able to do it and then sell some and then give some away to people that needed them. So, you know, when doing magic, if you're doing it for any length of time, I think that hopefully, you know, things in your life will get under control, and, you know, you're not sitting there going, well, I need to find a new lover, because you've done the spell. You've gotten your significant other. Or, oh my God, I need to pay the rent. So there's not a constant need for specific money magic to come in. And then what you're left with is a practice, a spiritual practice that you're upkeeping, and that's the time to let it spill out for other people, either professionally or not professionally, to, you know, again, let the light of realization that you have, let the light of divinity, that logos that lies within you, shine outward through actions. And in this case, you know, most of us spend a significant amount of time practicing magic, and we only have so much time, so we're left, well, this is my life's skill, and so that's what I'm going to give back to the world.
What you've described is what I call the raspberry jam law of magic. Everyone has experienced this. You cannot spread raspberry jam on bread without getting it on your own fingers. The same is true of any magical intention.
Yeah.
Now, this is, among other things, the basis for one of those taboo topics, magical ethics. Now, we tend to think of ethics as being a matter of some jerk in a with a funny collar standing up at a pulpit and telling you on Sunday morning to do all the not to do all the things that he does Saturday night. Okay, that is not ethics. That's hypocrisy. It's not ethics. I think it was Dan Fortune again who said, you know, ethics is important in magic as sanitation is in surgery. And for exactly the same reasons. If you neglect it, things go septic. And the raspberry jam law is the reason why. You cannot create an intention and direct it at anyone or anything else without it sticking to you. And so, you know, it depends on what you want in your life. I have had the most intriguing experiences with people who insist this law does not apply to them. Okay. And it's really quite remarkable, because they will insist with increasing force as their lives blow up, step by step, heading toward that eventual, you know, living in mom's basement next to the washing machine. Okay. It's just, you know the tone. And it's just one of those, okay, because there's no way to get past the, no, that's complete nonsense. You know, who cares that my health has just gone to hell, and my, you know, I lost my job, and I've lost my girlfriend, and just one thing after another. It doesn't matter how many times the universe rolls up the newspaper and whacks it across some people's nose, it doesn't get through. But in fact, you know, you can, you were saying a little while ago, magic is all about you. Well, in a certain sense, yes. One of the great flaws in magic is people trying to use it to manipulate others. One of the great booby traps. We were speaking of the perils of operative magic. And you will, I don't know, I've certainly encountered many, many people whose idea in terms of love magic isn't to change themselves, it's to manipulate some other person. Mm. Now, that, by the way, is, I'm a sufficiently nasty person to enjoy kind of vicariously watching what happens. When you warn somebody, do not do this, Okay, and they ignore you because this person that they barely know is the love of their life, and they built up this marvelous fantasy thing, and they want to put a love whammy on her. It's usually a guy on, well, sometimes the other way around. But at any rate, they want to put a love whammy on this other person. And the results, I don't know if others have had the same experience, but I've watched this half a dozen times. The result is absolutely predictable. The target goes through about half an hour of feeling unaccountably warm and fuzzy toward the perpetrator, and then shakes herself and says, "What the hell am I thinking?" Okay, and after that, can't stand him. And the magic rebounds, and he ends up absolutely besotted with somebody who can't stand him. You can work out the math from there. It is, as I say, if you have a sufficiently cruel sense of humor, it's amazing to watch. But it's like the people whose idea, you're talking lottery magic, okay? One thing, mooning around over winning the lottery will bring your life to a standstill. Mm. I've watched this over and over again. Everything in your life will screech to a halt to the extent that you spend your time mooning over the lottery. And the more you moon, the more of your life will just stop. It's a very powerful spell. I suggest you not practice it. But every time I've seen people set out to say, I'm going to get the universe to give me money that I don't earn, which is usually what cheap money magic amounts to. Okay. What are you actually doing here? You are saying, oh, universe, I want you to be more unjust in handing out money than you are. Because for you to get money that you didn't earn, somebody else had to earn it and not get it. Okay? Yeah, I know in the New Age community that's called zero-sum thinking, and it's wrong because it affirms the reality of limits, and we all know believing in limits is the worst possible thing in the world, since after all, it's not as though we're not wrecking the environment due to our inability to pay attention to limits. But what happens every single time, and I've watched this again probably two dozen times now, somebody will do this working to try to get money they don't earn, and they will suffer an immediate drastic financial loss. Somebody will break into their house and rob them blind, or the money that they have, the mutual fund, will turn out to be operated by, what was the guy?
Madoff.
Yeah, Bernard Madoff, who made off with the money. Yeah, and so on. It works like clockwork. Don't go there. So basically, yeah, magical ethics are essential in this. The raspberry jam principle is a good rule, as long as you think through what it is you're asking for.
Ethics also, for me, also includes love spells. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, but love spells for me are an absolute no-no. You cannot, you should not mess around with other people's emotions. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that really gets up my nose is this plethora of books that come out with 15 ways to make a love spell, you know? If the person you aspire to doesn't notice you, it's for a very good reason. Either you are not using the right aftershave, you haven't used your deodorant, or you're just a jerk. You know, love is something you have to work at. You meet someone and the sparks fly. Sometimes the sparks only fly one way. You cannot... you can't just hammer somebody into being your lover. You know, it's ridiculous. I've had two husbands and seven lovers. I've loved every one of them. Still not the last one. It was fun while it lasted. But it doesn't always last. And if you want a lasting relationship with someone, let it come naturally. Love is magical all by itself.
There is actually one absolutely infallible love spell. Make yourself lovable.
Yeah. You were very good at it.
I make a lot of love spell candles, just for,
Just FYI.
Just FYI. And I do get a lot of phone calls about they didn't work or what do I need to do. But I have to tell you, as I build this love spell candle and I build the ingredients, it is 100% of the time finding your own inner light. It is, even though Become More Lovable Candle does not sell. I'm letting you know.
Just don't tell them that that's what it's about.
Right. Well, you know, just like the forgiveness candle.
Wah, oh, wah, man. Wah.
Are you kidding? It got renamed the Heart Candle, and it's one of my best sellers. So, yeah, nobody wants to forgive shit. Anyway.
I've got Scorpio rising. I don't forgive.
So, but it's true with the love spell situation. I did, just as a little cautionary tale, I helped this one gentleman who was wanting to do a love spell, and he had a business, and he had a lot of people coming in and out of his business, and he said, I'm really lonely. So we set some stuff up for him and got him a candle and told him to do some things. And since I'm in his business regularly, it's a coffee shop, I watched women flirt outrageously with him. Drop the hanky, leave an extra big tip, all that stuff. And he goes, this love spell's not working. I said, are you kidding me? He goes, yeah, nobody's asked me out yet. But it's true with the love spell is that it is becoming more lovable. It is being open to love. And that's the one of the big things about operative magic is it works right up until it smashes right into your issue. And then it seems like it doesn't work. So it's time to look.
One of, as someone who hung a sign out on you know, their cyber door and said, you know, I'm a professional sorcerer, I'll, you know, take some cases. That kind of sign.
Not the right sign.
One of the most heartbreaking things is the fact that, and I get 3-4 emails a week for, I want so-and-so to fall in love with me. I want so-and-so to leave, to come back to me. I want so-and-so, I want you to break so-and-so up so that they come back to me. And I'll politely explain that I don't do that. I will make a talisman that will help draw a love to you in sort of a more general field type of way, which I think is drastically different. And no, that's not what I want. I want that one. And you know, the level between this and active cursing is actually no line. I'll tell you, I went out and I have in my possession a candle. It's a red candle called Omnipresencia de Dios, the omnipresence of God. And on the front of the candle is this very benefic looking God in the clouds with the beard, and he's holding scales of judgment, and there's angels and things like this. And I was like, oh, this is nice. And I turned it around, and on the back of the candle, it is, I summon you shades of the dead from hell, that you go forth and drag blank, because, you know, you fill in the name, to come and love me and submit to me before my feet, lest, you know, and should they not, you will follow them all the days of their life and hound them until, you know, the end. Now here's
the thing.
Sounds
like a good BDSM porn novel.
Here's the thing. I didn't get this candle at a botanica or a magic store. I got it at a ShopRite.
You didn't get it between the worlds by any chance?
No, I got it at a supermarket. at a regular supermarket.
Mm-hmm. I think that's awesome. I want to know where that market is.
It's, you know... I mean, you know, on the one hand, there are those of us, you know, and I myself have been guilty of, you know, complaining about the fluffy bunnies, want everything to be sweetness and light, and, you know, there's real magic, and there's a time for wrath, and, you know, again, in Tibetan Buddhism, there's a lot of wrathful, compassionate magic, and, you know, Lama La, what does the razor mantra do, you know, and you're expecting, oh, it's to route up compassion. He's like, oh no, it's for like Hitler or something. It kills people. It's like, oh, you know, thank you, Rinpoche. like, you know, so maybe not say that one more than 10 times. so, but on the one hand, you've got this sort of what the stereotypical sweetness and light, and real witches would never do that because they know about karma and things like that. And but on the other hand, you have, it's got to be the deepest, darkest, worst possible thing, and it's just, it's worse, it's depressing. It's the same side of the coin. It's, you know, it's dark for darkness' sake, and it, dork for dorkness' sake in many cases.
Thank you.
But
see previous comment about people sleeping next to mom's washing machine.
You know, exactly. If anything, I would prefer the sweetness and light people because at least the motivation is good. When it's the other way, it's like, you know, you're obsessed with the world being one way, and because of the raspberry jam effect, you know, you are surrounded by this. Very often what people are thinking is karmic backlash or something like that is just the raspberry jam effect, which is why a lot of people in traditions that work wrathful magic heavily, they'll have like that kind of altar outside in a shed, not in the house. but it still affects the person. It affects who you are. You can't just get rid of it by having it out in the backyard. And I'm not saying there's never a time to do things that work with those forces, but it should be rare. And, you know, certainly not to find the love of your life.
I think with the raspberry jam effect, and I love that as a teaching tool, so I'm going to steal that and reference you all the time.
By all means.
So for people who do this professionally, talking about magic being a profession, or if you feel like a lot of people who... come to conferences like this, talk about how do I transition into doing this. You know, I feel like this is my calling. And one of the things that nobody ever told me, so I guess I'm going to pass this along to you, is that if you open up a practice, whether it be a healing practice, whether it be a magical practice, a consultation practice, you know, or any combination thereof, be prepared for your clientele to kind of mirror all your triggers and buttons and issues. You know, whatever is unresolved in you will be walking through the door every day. Or whatever is your hot button of like, oh, I'm so over that, shouldn't they know that? But, you know, they don't because they're just starting out. Mm. But people will constantly mirror that, and people will constantly teach you. So I find having a practice to be a really great part, an operative magic practice for the public and doing healing work for the public, a really great mirror in my own spiritual practice. It really shows me where I'm still wounded. It really shows me where I'm still working on. It really kind of presses my buttons in a visceral way that, you know, maybe my coven wouldn't do so much or my family wouldn't do so much, but these strangers off the street, whoa, you know, oh, I was thinking like that, or I'm still thinking like that. It's been profoundly healing for me to work with other people. So it's not just a giving out situation. I think even when you're working with people, whether it be in the context of sessions and receiving compensation for it, or if you're helping out and ministering to your community in the role of a minister and not necessarily getting a consultation fee, there's a great exchange that's still going on there. And I don't think that's often talked about often enough. I don't think any of my teachers actually said that as I started this path and working with the public. So if you desire this, keep that in mind. It's a good thing, but it might be a surprising thing.
I attended Evo's talk yesterday, and it brought a lot of things up, things that I wanted to think about. There is in all of us those of us who aspire to be or consider themselves to be who actually are magicians, there is a darker side to us. And that is something that we do have to acknowledge. It doesn't necessarily mean that you have to give in to that darker side, but you need to acknowledge that it's there. We all get times when, if magic was of the storybook kind, we would like to sort of turn around and sort of go boom at somebody and see them dissolve. I mean, you know, usually when people nip in and take the last parking space, things like that, there is a darker side to magic. There is no doubt about that. And I take on board what has just been said, that when you deal with people, whether they are students or whether you are acting as a consultant or something like that, they will press your buttons. And there are times when, you know, that darker side does come up and hit you in the back of the neck. But you learn to control that. You learn to face it and you learn to acknowledge that it's there, because you have to balance. You can't be all sweetness and light. You can't be all darkness and blackness. You have to balance. And I think when it comes down to it, that's the greatest thing a magician can have and aspire to, is balance within yourself.
Those who belong to a certain initiatory tradition will remember that the royal secret is equilibrium.
Okay. The royal secret is equilibrium.
They haven't needed me at all.
We like you anyway.
Well, I know. And it is my painful duty to say that we're coming toward the end of the time that we have. But what I would like to do...
Is that what's called a sense of awe?
Oh. Yeah, that's the awe. Oh, but we do have a few minutes, and what I would like, if you all would be willing to do so, is to just give that last thought about magic and the impact on the individual of the operative magic and how it affects that individual and the world around them. Whatever it is that you think that you really would like everyone in this room to walk out here with ringing in their mind. And I'll give you 2 minutes.
Learn to love yourself, because if you love yourself, you'll be able to love everyone else.
Magic is not for everyone. It's a huge amount of hard work. It is a demanding, risky, challenging, and very poorly paid profession. And it's not for everyone. We have a tendency in our society to say, well, yes, this is for everyone, that is for everyone. Magic is not for everyone. And I will occasionally get encounter the sort of, either the sort of clueless religious type or the clueless secular type who says, I don't think people should dabble in magic. And I say, I agree. If you're going to deal with magic, don't dabble in it. You have to dive in. Make it your life. Because anything else really isn't safe. A little knowledge is a lethal thing in this business. Well, not primarily lethal. It mostly leads either to failure and misery or simply to psychosis. I've seen examples of both, and it is not a pretty sight. This is one of those things that you have to fling yourself into full, you know, knowing the risks, knowing the challenges, knowing that you're going to spend a lot of time not making a lot of money off magic, and see where it takes you. And as with anything else, as with being a writer, being a musician, being a martial artist, you have to want to do it because you want to do it, not because you have some delusional fantasy of, you know, becoming Gandalf. That, by the way, was what I wanted when I was 10 years old.
Very
oh, well.
Succeeded. And
I'm still disappointed the beard never got to my belt buckle.
Yeah, I was trying to grow it down to here. ZZ Top leg.
For anyone that's taken any of my classes, there's one thing that I always come back to, and that is to meditate. And here's the thing. Meditation, the most objectionable thing in my course of people are like, oh man, the meditation. And people will write other authors and say, do you do all this meditation? You know, it's really... And it's like the anti-magic thing, but it's the thing that will unlock the rest of it and keep you sane and help put the rest of your life in perspective. But we, as witches and magicians, we have a problem with it because meditation requires a lot of sitting down and doing nothing. And we like to stand up and move around and draw things in the air, and we like to do stuff. Meditation requires a lot of silence, and we like to speak the words of power to the quarters and get a response. More than any of that, we like to see things. And meditation requires that we sit down and focus on the point of the meditation and not be swept away by the images of the goddess. The phrase, if you see a Buddha on the road, kill him, is a Buddhist phrase. And the idea is that you are the Buddha. The Buddha is within you. Enlightenment is within you. It's not about a beatific vision of Shakyamuni or whatever Buddha appears in front of you for you to bow down to. So in the case of meditation for witches and magicians, you know, we're programmed to see stuff. I mean, some of us close our eyes and it's like HDTV, you know? It's like, so it requires sitting down and like, I'm going to sit down and meditate now, and you close your eyes. And all of a sudden, Kali is like, you know, I'm the goddess Kali, and I need you, Evo, to go on a special quest. And the thing is, for Evo to meditate, he should be, well, Kali, that's fine, but I'm meditating right now. So I'll make some time for you at the end of the session, if you would please. Office hours are between. And that's, you know, that's how it is. Because a lot of us, we make offerings, and spirits like offerings. So all of a sudden, we start to attract spirits. And we come into people who maybe they don't make offerings or pay attention, but they do, you know, lots of prayers to gods. And then their spirits are like, well, wait a minute, he pays all his spirits and pays attention. I'm going to go hang out with John. So, you know, then things show up. And we, you know, we meditate, and it's very important to know your own mind, because more than knowing the mind of whatever external divinity you're focusing on, you must know your own mind, because you only know anything through your own mind. If I was to jump down and smack you over the head with a chair,
you
definitely would. I want you in the bar tonight with backup with your cane. So I am hiding behind Dolores. But, you know, if Dolores was to smack you with her cane, you would only know it through your own mind. And it is the most important, and the best thing is you cannot be bad at meditation. I'm probably going over my 2 minutes, but that's the second thing, is you cannot be bad at meditation. Just sit and do
very
it.
Good.
For me, I guess the last thought would be about looking at the deeper magic or more the blend of operative magic and more of the spiritual or higher god magic as a conversation. You know, I think a lot of people get into magic, and myself included at various times, with that whole, we've been talking about the I want to manifest this, I want to gain that, and it's this kind of asking, talking, speaking at the universe, divinity, your own God self, whatever you want to think of it that you're connecting to, however you personalize it. But there's not a whole lot of the listening. So I really distinguish between spellcraft and magic. I think magic is the whole conversation. And spellcraft might be the communication where you're expressing yourself, and you've got to be able to also hear no. I think a lot of times we're not willing to hear no and kind of just tune into that deeper wisdom, and maybe this is not the best idea, and can you gain in this process the skill sets to be able to hear when this is a good idea, you know, when you should be doing something for yourself, when you should be doing something for somebody else, and maybe when you should just quiet down and wait. And that's a hard thing for us to hear. And I think building those, like for meditation, I agree totally with what Jason said. In our more serious training, if you study with us through the different degrees, the first year is almost all meditation, you know, and it's kind of intuitive development for people who need to kind of get clear on that. And if you can't sit and meditate for a year, I don't really want it to be teaching you how to do operative magic. So it becomes that kind of threshold because people get bored really quickly. So it becomes a little safety net. But really develop the conversation.
I'm bad at meditation. No, I'm fairly impatient. I'm fairly impatient in this. And so I create moments of meditation for myself where I'm kind of forced to wait in line. And but the big thing, the takeaway I'd like to leave you with is that magic requires surrender. It requires a surrender of your pain. And when you surrender your pain and you surrender it to whatever conversation you have with whatever divine being, is that you're no longer working from it. And when you're no longer working from your pain, you're no longer conversing through your pain to the other person's pain. And I know that gets a little woo-woo for our operative magic here, but I think that's the first piece of magic you can do, is because we often, in a moment, in road rage, in waiting in line, we are all working from our pain. And when your magic, your spellcraft smacks up against it, it's no longer working. So if you can surrender your pain, what you might find is you don't need as much spellcraft as you thought you did. Damn it, I just lost some candle sales.
I want to thank Dolores and John and Jason and Christopher and Jackie for sharing their thoughts with us, for being on this panel, apparently a surprise to some people. And you may give them a round of applause. Thank you very much, guys.
Tonight at the bar, don't miss it.
Tonight at the gala, before everybody
goes...
Do
you want a bar fight at the gala?
This is fine. Before everybody rushes out, remember, the next session starts at 11:30. I do have one or two things to say, just really quickly. At the gala tonight, we do have the silent auction. So, and we are capable of taking credit cards. So remember that all the proceeds from the silent auction goes to the New Alexandrian Library. We got a photograph from our contractor yesterday afternoon. They put the last five panels of the dome in. So the dome structure is done. So the dome structure is complete. And on to the next things. If you want to see pictures of the progress and everything, I will be at the registration table during lunch. I'll have my laptop. I have things down, and they will be on Facebook once I get home. Okay.
For NAL, did Michael Smith the stately pleasure dome decree?
All of these, all of the presenters have things in the vendors area. Their books, their candles, other materials, please support. This entire panel was a piece of operative magic, so please go and buy their books. Give them their £10. So have a great rest of the conference. Thank you very much. Thank you.
get away.
Yeah.